Turn over to Matthew 9, if you would. I'm going to start there briefly, and then we'll get over to 2 Corinthians again, but Matthew 9. I was going to say a bunch of nice stuff about Barry until he just wished me dead, but yeah, that's right. I want to take just a minute, and I'm actually going to try to use this text to both introduce the lesson tonight and make a few comments about some relationships I have here. And I promise, I think, all of this will tie together. I'm tired from the week in good ways, not the kind of tired where I'm disappointed, but I'm tired because I'm full with meeting new people, being with loved ones, hearing preaching that's challenging and heart-wrenching. And anybody that knows me knows I'm already emotional, and when I'm tired, I'm more emotional, so you guys just hang on tonight. Matthew chapter 9, verse 36. Seeing the multitudes, or the people, Jesus felt compassion for them because they were distressed and dispirited like sheep without a shepherd. Now, earlier in the week, I pointed out that in that verse, we often get that sort of flipped upside down, that when we see the crowds of people, we have compassion on ourselves because we're distressed and dispirited by the people that don't have a shepherd. But if we're going to become like Jesus, if we're going to become like Paul, if we're going to become people who work with God to reach the lost, we have to not have compassion on ourselves or be distressed for ourselves. Listen, we've found rest. We know the shepherd. We should have the peace that passes understanding no matter how dark the world gets. But we've got to flip this the right way and have compassion on people around us. Look at the next verse. Verse 37 says, Jesus said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Therefore, beseech the Lord of the harvest to send out workers into his harvest." Could I tell you that when Jesus said that, I have a feeling that his disciples thought that was as wrong as we do today. This is another one of those things that we get flipped exactly upside down, just like the last verse. Here's how most Christians talk. You know, the problem is, the reason we're not winning souls and we're not finding anybody, it's because nobody out there is interested. There isn't anybody that cares anymore. And we think exactly opposite of this. We think the workers are many. Look at us. There's all of us workers in here. But the reason it's not happening is because the harvest is few. There's not very many people out there. And Jesus just said, you're wrong about that. It's always been the worker problem in God's world. Always. I think a lot of us think we are workers, or we want to be workers. But every day we go by people who need to hear the good news, and we don't share it. I'm guilty. Now, the reason I was bringing this text up is not just that, and it fits into our lesson, but that last verse, verse 38, where Jesus asks us to beseech God, to pray to God, that he send out workers into the harvest. Have you ever heard somebody pray that? Like in their public prayer, say, God, send forth reapers, send forth harvesters. Anybody ever heard that? I grew up hearing my father pray that. My dad would get up in the pulpit and he would pray, and one of the things he said pretty often in his prayers is, Lord, send forth reapers. Where I grew up, we had some preacher problems. I told you that my dad is very evangelistic. He was always trying to share the gospel, but he had kind of a bad taste in his mouth for the guys that usually stood up here, because some of the guys that came through my little hometown really caused a lot more trouble than they did good. I remember one time coming out of a, a meeting when I was a kid, and I think my dad had been in a men's business meeting, and as we were walking out to the car, he had kind of tears in his eyes, and I heard him say under his breath, "God save us from preachers." And yet, he always prayed, "Send forth reapers." Well, somewhere in my teenage years, it got into my heart that I needed to be one of them. I didn't want to stand in a pulpit. In fact, I still hate it. That's why I stand down here when I can. I don't like this part of the work of preaching, though I know it needs to be done, and I believe it's part of what I have to do in my life. But I got in my head that I needed to be talking to people about the Lord, so I tried to as a teenager. And God did amazing things with some of that, but I knew I could do better. So I started I went to the preacher where I worshiped. It wasn't Barry Kirchville. And I said, hey, I want to learn how to teach better. I want to learn how to preach better. I want you to help me learn to do better at the work that I want to do. And he said, well, I can't really help you. You know, you're more evangelistic than I am anyway. But if you want to preach anytime, I'll let you. But I'm not going to spend any time with you to help you do that. He said, there might be some other guys around here in Southern California that'll do it, but it's not me. Ask one of them, but don't ask Barry Kirchville. I didn't know Barry. I mean, I knew of Barry, but I didn't know him. And I thought, yeah, I've seen that guy. I think that's probably right. You know? Yeah. I literally asked every other preacher I knew around there, and they all told me the same thing. I can't really spend much time with you. I'm not really the guy to help you. But if you ever want to preach in the pulpit, you can do that. And so I was able to do that, but I finally had no options left except Barry Kirchville. And one day I came in, he didn't really know me well, but I sat down in his office and I said, my palms were sweaty, I was nervous. I said, Barry, I need to ask you a question. I'm not asking for support, I'm not asking for money, I'm not asking for like an official training program, but I'd really like to become a better teacher and preacher. Would you spend time with me? Do you remember what you said? No, you didn't say yes. He kind of leaned back in his chair and he said, you ever taught anybody, an unbeliever? And I said, man, I'm trying. I said, I've got 5 studies this week, and that's the problem is I don't really know how to do that very well. And he went, you know how Barry does that? You got 5 studies this week? Yeah. Oh, I'll teach you. Oh, yeah, come on, I'll do it. And I said, you know, the guy across town told me not to ask you. And he said, that guy, I wasn't going to teach him. By the way, that guy left the Lord, left his family, left his kid, quit the Lord. Barry could see it coming, couldn't you? And then Barry, like, pulled the rug out from under me. I quit my job at a really cool place. Life was really good. I was in love with a girl there. And the first day I walked in to have like a Monday morning study with him, I'd never studied with him in the mornings. We'd always been together in the evenings for a couple weeks. I walk into the church building in El Cajon and he says, hey, don't quit your job. I'm moving to Arkansas. Barry, you knew I was quitting my job. Oh, but I just didn't really know if I was going to move and I didn't really think you were going to quit your job. So, I'm going to Arkansas. Tell you what I was most afraid of. I was most afraid to tell my father. Because what it was turning into, it was looking like, is I was going to go into a training program. There were people beginning to be willing to support me. And I might become a preacher that stands up there and makes his living with the gospel. And I was so scared to tell my dad. The guy who always prayed, send forth reapers. So I sat down one day and I said, Dad, I'm moving to Arkansas. He said, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Dad, I think I'm going to be a preacher." And he looked down and got quiet. And he said, "Well, boy, don't let your ego get involved." That's what he said. And he never said another word to me about it. I never heard, "I'm proud of you." I never heard, "How's it going?" He just waved goodbye as I went to Arkansas. I got a bunch of cool stories about the Kirchervilles if you want to hear them later. Some really funny stuff. One of the greatest blessings of my life. Barry's kind of like a dad in some ways to me. You know how they say that you can tell a father by his children? I've got two boys, and when they meet one of my boys, they're like, "Hey, he's a lot like you." Then when they meet my other boy, they say, "Hey, he's a lot like you." And then when you meet both my boys, they say, "There you are." Like a father summed up in the summation of his kids, right? You guys got a taste of that this week with Britt and I. We're different, but together we preach as long as Barry. Like two equals one. Like that's... Back to this harvest thing. Barry was helping to train me to be somebody who would work in God's field. He had promised me 2 years with him. And I don't remember exactly where it was, but at like the year and 4 month mark, he came to me and he said, "Hey, you're ready to go." And I said, "No, I got more months left with you." Like, that's what we agreed to. He said, "Now you're ready." And I said, "I'm not ready. Why you keep saying I'm ready?" I knew there was something. And he finally said, "Look, Brent, my son, is about to graduate college. He's getting a degree in accounting. But Andy, he said to me the other day, 'Dad, I'm kind of thinking about preaching.'" And Barry looked at me and he said, "You gotta go, man. Because if I don't take this moment, this opportunity, I've always hoped that Brent would use his gifts for God. And if I don't take this moment, I'm not sure if he'll do it." Was he right? So Barry kicked me out. I want to tell one more thing about that. When we moved from San Diego, California to Fayetteville, Arkansas, when we got there, there had been a preacher there before us who had really done good work. I never met him. His name was Steve Cawthon. And everybody there talked about what a wonderful man he was, and his wife, his family. But Steve died. And that's his boy, Patrick. I don't know Patrick very well, but I really love his spirit. He is joyful, he's engaging, he's contagious. I've never heard him teach, but I can tell he's loved, and I can tell he loves you. And I'm so glad you have a person like that to balance Barry. Nah, Barry loves deeply. He's just a little rough around the edges. No, you know, I preach in a two-preacher situation, and we're very different. But God gets a lot of work done through this. But, you know, I was thinking about this with this lesson. And I asked Patrick this a few minutes ago. If your dad hadn't died, would you still be a preacher? And he kind of said, I guess I've not thought much about it. If my mom hadn't died, I'm pretty sure I wouldn't be. There are reasons that sometimes things happen in our life that we end up being servants to people who are hurting, who have broken hearts, who feel lost. And a lot of times it's because we've been through similar things, And God's helped us, and now we've got something to tell, you know. But here is the question for tonight. And this isn't just about becoming a preacher who stands up in a pulpit, but are you willing and ready to enter into the work of the harvest? Are you? We've been talking about it all this week from 2 Corinthians chapter 3 through 6, where Paul was pouring out his heart, opening up his chest, and telling these Corinthians, you guys are immature and selfish and thinking about yourselves, but I need to show you the inside of me so that you'll know that it's possible to work with God in this world. We can be fellow workers with God. But you've got to escape something before you'll ever get on board with this. So go to chapter 6 of 2 Corinthians. And look at the language here for the lesson tonight. Verse 11 through 13. Our mouth has spoken freely to you, O Corinthians. Our heart is open wide. You are not restrained by us, but you are restrained in your own affection. Now, in a like exchange, I speak as to children, open wide to us also. You know, this little paragraph, as he gets to the end of this section, this parenthetical that I was showing you in the text, he gets there and he says, listen, we've been saying everything we can think to say. Like, we're just pouring out our heart here. And I'm asking you to open up your heart also. So the title of this lesson is, Open Up Your Heart and Escape Your Affections. Now, I have to deal with this. Look at verse 12 again. Verse 12 is a really hard verse to translate. In the New American Standard, it says something like this. You're not restrained by us, you're restrained by your own affections. But if you've got the NIV or the New Living Translation or the CSB, one of these more modern translations, it reads completely different. Anybody have a version that reads completely different than that? What's yours say? You're not restricted. That's not completely different, but it's close. All right. So some versions say this. We're not withholding our affection from you. You're withholding your affection from us. You see how different that is? So here's the debate. Does this verse mean, is Paul getting to the Corinthians and saying, hey guys, I'm loving you and I'm not withholding any affection from you. You're withholding your affection from me. You see, there was a problem in Corinth where the false teachers had kind of turned the hearts of the Corinthians away. That's why so many times in the book he's going to say things like, you don't think I love you? Of course I love you. Places like 2 Corinthians 2, 4, 11, 11, 12, 15. Remember we talked about how when he couldn't find Titus, he couldn't even go through the open door in Troas, because Titus was bringing word. I mean, everything he's saying in this book is, guys, I love you deeply, but you've sort of lost your love for me. So here's how some translators deal with this verse. What they think Paul is saying is, come on, guys, I love you. Please love me back. There might be something to that. But I think it's much deeper than that. Paul's concern in this book is not just that the Corinthians would like him or love him. That's not really any preacher's concern, a good preacher. What they really care about, what Paul really cared about, was for them not just to love Paul, but to love God and to do God's work. That's what he says at the end of the letter when he says, you think we've been defending ourselves this whole time. We're not defending ourselves. We're trying to build you up. Now, let me say, what I'm getting at is I think the translations that make it more about them being restrained by their affections fits the context better. Like even toward the end when he says, I speak to his children, open wide to us also. Think about this just for a minute. Those of you with little children, do you have to tell a little child to love you? Do you have to do that? No way. Your little children just love you. You know who you have to say that to? Teenagers. You have to say to teenagers things like, hey, have you forgotten like all the things that I was in labor for 24 hours with you and that I like fed you all those years? And because here's what happens to a teenager. They begin to have other affections, friends, things they love, places they find comfort. And so sometimes you go through this thing where you're like, hey, I'm like pouring everything out and it doesn't seem like you care about me. Please open wide to me also. Give your affection to me. You ever had that conversation with your teenagers? But let me ask it again. Is that really your deepest concern? That your kids love you? I don't think that's the deepest concern. You know, what most of us want for our children is for them to make sure their affections are set on the right things. And that if they can escape the affections that make them lazy or distracted, and they can understand the more important things in life, then they're going to be successful in life. Here's how it looks, and I'm going to go ahead and say this to the young people. When you're growing up, you begin to have these affections for things like comfort. So when you wake up in the morning, your bed feels really good. It's warm and soft. And you know that you should probably get up and read your Bible and go to school and like do the things you're supposed to do. But you can't overcome your affection for comfort. So you roll back over and go to sleep. And your parents come in and you're like, kid, grow up. And you're like, leave me alone. What I think Paul's doing to the Corinthians is something like this. The reason you guys are being lazy, the reason you guys aren't engaging, the reason that you guys can't see that there's so much more going on in the world, in the universe, is that you're in love with things that keep you in a straitjacket. That's the language of verse 12. It literally means straight. You're stuck in a straight, like a straitjacket or a narrow way. I think the old King James Version uses that. And what's really stopping you is your bowels, your affections. Someone is, again, I don't know this church very well, but I'm going to suggest something. There's a few people in this congregation who really pour their life into doing God's work. And you know who they are. They don't have to stand up in a pulpit, but they spend an enormous amount of their time serving people, encouraging people, try to talk to people. But if you're like other churches, there's a lot of you that don't do very much of that. And the reason is, there are some things you love more. Sometimes it's really simple stuff. I don't know if you've ever heard anybody say this. I know you've heard this phrase. You know, the threat to the best is not the worst. The threat to the best thing is second best. Because most people will look at second best and think, well, that's great when there's something better. And the devil knows this. The devil knows that to get you to not do God's work, he's not going to try to get you to do the things in the worst possible way. He's going to convince you that if you do like the second best thing, then you're spiritually minded. And here's what I think's happened in American culture. Most Christians have convinced themselves that the ultimate thing in the service of God is to focus on the family. That's a ministry. It's a ministry that actually came about because a lot of fathers weren't doing what they were supposed to, and Christian families were falling apart, and people said, we got to focus on family, guys. But what happened was a lot of people thought, hey, if we focus on family, and as long as every night of every week I'm with my family doing things where we love each other and things are great and our families are healthy, we're doing the work of God. Do you know why evangelism doesn't happen in most churches? That's why. Not because people are a bunch of losers who are doing all kinds of terrible things, but they actually just have other affections. Jesus didn't talk like that. Jesus never said, focus on the family. He said things like, seek first the kingdom. Whoever loves father and mother more than me is not worthy of me. And I just want to spend a couple of minutes to get your mind thinking about what affections might be keeping us from doing the work of God. Jesus had this problem with his own disciples. Look at Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. When Jesus first chose the apostles, I believe personally that most of them were probably teenagers. There's a lot of scholarship that believes that as well. I'm not a scholar, but I think most of these guys would have been teenagers. Peter probably, they think, was the oldest, maybe being in his early 20s. But a lot of these young men, Jesus was calling them from their families, from their family business. They were beginning to follow him on the road. He was beginning to train them. You remember what happens in Matthew 10? He sends them out on what we call the limited commission. I want you to think about these young guys going on this mission trip all through Israel, and Jesus is telling them it's not going to be very easy. People aren't going to like what you have to say. There's going to be trouble. There's going to be difficulty. And in the middle of this tremendous speech he's giving them to get them ready for the road, listen to what he says in Matthew 10, 32. Everyone who confesses me before men, I will also confess him before my Father who's in heaven. Whoever denies me before men, I will deny him before my Father who's in heaven. Do not think that I came to bring peace on the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. I came to set a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's enemies will be the members of his household. He who loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He who loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. He who does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. He who has found his life will lose it, and he who has lost his life for my sake will find it. Why did Jesus say those things to those guys going out on the road? You think they probably got out there, and after a few days or a few weeks, a couple of them started thinking, I miss mom. I miss a home-cooked meal. I miss a place where people aren't looking at me like all these people are looking at me. I think I'm just going to go back. You know what Jesus was trying to train them to love? To love the work of God and the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And it was going to cost them a lot at times. But the only thing that would overcome that and keep them going would be if their affections changed. And they loved God more than they loved anything that kept them from doing the work of God. Brent did a great job with the text over in John chapter 21. You remember after the resurrection, and the disciples were confused and the apostles didn't know what was going on. They went back to what was comfortable for them. Jesus meets them on the seashore. He calls them in. He takes Peter aside. And do you remember what the conversation was about? Where are your affections? Do you love me more than these? Whether that was the boats, whether that was the people in Bethsaida, whether that was the disciples, or whether it was the fish. Do you love me more than the things that you tend to want to go do with your time? I've always liked that text because of what Peter said. Peter said, I'm going fishing. We actually made a plaque and put that in my dad's house because he likes to fish. It's a great verse. I'm going fishing. I love fishing. Some of you have even asked me this week, hey, you live in Minnesota. Do you get to fish much? You know what my answer is? I don't. You know why? Because every time I go try to fish anymore, I lose interest. I don't know what happened to me. Like, I like it for a bit, but after a little while of fishing, sometimes even just a day, I start thinking in my head, there's something I love more than this. I wish I was in a coffee shop with somebody with a Bible open. I wish that I was spending some time doing something that matters more to me than catching fish now. I'm not trying to say that in a braggadocious way. I'm not. And I don't know when God changed my affections about that. But there are other things and other times where I still wrestle with this. That I'm not doing the work of God as I should because there's things that I like to do otherwise. Let me point out, it wasn't just Jesus that had this problem. It was the apostles who had this problem with people they were trying to train. Look at Acts chapter 13. Acts 13, Paul's first missionary journey. It's just a few verses, like 12 verses, where they leave Antioch and they begin to sail across the Mediterranean. But those few verses, I would suggest, weren't easy days. Like if you could imagine being in the ancient world on a boat, going, trying to get to Asia Minor, and you finally get to Asia Minor, you set foot on land. Verse 13 says, "Now Paul and his companions put out to sea from Paphos, came to Perga and Pamphylia." Listen to this. "But John left them and returned to Jerusalem." Why? I have no idea. I have no idea why John Mark decided to stop going on the missionary journey and turn back and go to Jerusalem, but I have a guess. There were some things that he loved more than being uncomfortable like this. And it bothered Paul, didn't it? Because you remember when you get to Acts chapter 15 and they're about to go on another journey, Barnabas is like, "All right, let's go. Let's bring John Mark." And Paul says, "Not a chance. I'm done with these people that desert and have other affections." By the way, Barnabas was right about John Mark. Sometimes people who have failed and given in to other affections can get back on track and can actually do the work of God. Later on, Paul would say, "Hey, bring John Mark with you. He's useful. He's a good man." One of my most heartbreaking passages about something like this is in Philippians chapter 2. Look at Philippians 2. Verse 19, Paul wrote this, "But I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you shortly, so that I also may be encouraged when I learn of your condition." You know, that's an encouraging verse. "Hey, I'm going to send Timothy to you. I want to hear how you're doing." This next verse, though, if you really think about it, it's gut-wrenching. Listen to what he says next. "For I have no one else of kindred spirit who will be genuinely concerned for your welfare." Wait, Paul. You're telling me that among all those Christians and all those people that have traveled with you, all your traveling companions, you've looked for a volunteer to go back to Philippi, and nobody's willing to go? No one else has a kindred spirit like you do to love them? And he said, "That's right, no one does. Only Timothy. One guy out of all my crew has a kindred spirit to go help you." Look at the next verse. "For they all seek after their own interests, not those of Christ Jesus." Maybe they looked at Epaphroditus, who had made that journey, and that guy almost died. And they thought something like, "Well, I'm sure you love those Philippians, Paul. And I'd really love them too. But that guy almost died. And I really like my life." But Timothy was like, "I'll go." When I first preached this lesson up home, I took this moment to try to illustrate it. We have a preacher there, Rick Lanning. Rick goes to China just about every year. And China's not an easy place to go. Every time he goes, he's nervous. His wife's a little bit of a wreck. All of us are prayerful. He's had some things happen over there that were scary. So I illustrated it this way. I said, all right, Rick loves the Christians in China, and he loves going over there and doing God's work. But let's say that Rick can't go back anymore. He can't go check on the loved ones. He can't go over there and preach. And I said this to the congregation. I said, how many of you have the kindred spirit that Rick does to go to China in his place? I just asked it like that. I didn't say, raise your hand. I didn't say that. I just asked it. Most people look down. One little boy on the front pew went, me! Jackson Bidney. You know why? Because that little boy doesn't know how many things there are to love in the world yet. He's not burdened down with the affections of all of his comforts. He's not afraid of China. But do you know what fear really is? Fear is an indicator of what we have affection for. If I'm afraid of my safety, I love my safety. If I'm afraid of being uncomfortable, I love my comfort. If I'm afraid of just whatever it is, that's an affection that keeps me from moving forward to do the thing that needs to be done. And I know those are big examples, but that's not even the hardest thing. There are ways the Bible describes us serving God and serving Him with each other, like in Galatians chapter 6, verses 1 through 10. Bear one another's burdens, thereby fulfill the law of Christ. Do you know why some Christians don't engage in that behavior? They don't get to know their fellow members, and they don't find out what's happening in their life, and they don't go spend evenings with them or weekends or go out to, you know, coffee and really talk about things that matter. You know why some Christians don't do that? I'm just going to quote them. It's a literal quote. Well, most of my evenings, you know, I'm like with my family, and we really like this show that's on Thursday nights. Somebody said that to me one time. I had invited them to come be a part of something that I thought they could be helpful with, but they really love that show on Thursday nights. Now, I'm not, again, the beauty of not knowing a group is I don't know your situation. Maybe everybody in this church is often just putting themselves in uncomfortable situations and pushing themselves to do the work of God, and you've got no other affection except God's work. But my guess is that nobody's getting out of this lesson alive tonight. That's my guess. And so I want you to think deeply about it. Is your heart open? Are you restrained in doing the work of God because of your own affections? One of the things I really love about this congregation is that it seems to be a congregation at peace, mostly. You seem to talk about the things that matter. But I've actually been in places in the country where when I go there, there's no evangelistic work being done. You know, the only thing that's being done is they're arguing about their personal liberties. They're talking about things like, can a Christian drink or can the Christian not drink? Can this, that, and the other thing? And they're spending all their time debating all this stuff. And I keep thinking, like, why aren't you doing the work of God? Well, because we love our liberties. You know, some of us like our wine. Well, what if it meant giving up a liberty, not just to spend some time, but giving up a liberty because somebody may misunderstand what you're doing, but your affections are restraining you from actually doing the work of God? Now, the application is yours. Like, I think you see the point of that. I hope that it's something that will inspire you. But I just want to say publicly, I appreciate people like Brent. I know his affection was not for standing in front of a group of people and preaching to you. Did you know he still hates that? He still gets sweaty The reason his wife hands him a water bottle when he's done is because his mouth is like cotton when he's done. Like, he freaks out every time. I appreciate people like Chip and Christy. Chip came up to Minnesota and was willing to be an elder there. And I know that wasn't comfortable always. But Chip was willing to do the work of God and really put off other things in his life to serve us in that way. And I appreciate all of you that I don't know who do that kind of thing in your families, in your neighborhoods, with your friends. But for all of us, here's the question for tonight. Could we open our hearts wider? Could we escape some more of our affections to help us more effectively do the work of God? And I hope the answer is yes. We're going to offer an invitation song. If you'd like to become a Christian tonight, leave the affections that you have in this world to have just the affection for Jesus. Come to Him. Love Him most. He'll save you. Let's go ahead and stand and sing. And if we can help you tonight, let us know how.